Welcome everyone to the Goldster podcast, where we take you behind the scenes with guests of all shades and styles to hear enriching stories about their lives, their victories, their failures, their dreams. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, your host, and today we're talking purpose, passion, and grit. Please enjoy. And to find out more, check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. And without further ado, let us begin. Hello and welcome wherever you are in the world, in Europe, even in Russia, to this very special Purpose, Passion and Grit, the Goldster Show, where we talk to people who have a vision and a love, that's their passion, see mountains and turbulence that they need to conquer, that's their purpose, and have the stamina and courage to stay with it. That is their grit. The purpose, passion, and grit of today's guest has a place in all our hearts because he is a Russian politician, a democracy activist, and he is living in exile. He is the close friend and colleague of one of Russia's leading opposition figures, Alexei Navalny, who is currently serving a 9-year sentence in a maximum security prison. And last week, another figure, Ilya Yashin, was jailed for 8.5 years after he criticized the Kremlin's war in Ukraine. What is happening to Russia, and how will those fighting it ultimately prevail? My guest was raised in a comparative utopia, I suppose, a family of academics and Soviet Jewish intelligentsia. And as a young man, he became a local councillor or a deputy in his local city in Western Russia. These were better days when Russia and the West were more friendly. And with colleagues, he pioneered political campaigning through the internet, live streaming and getting messages through to the grassroots. And then the iron fist of Vladimir Putin's Russia came crashing down. From exile and from prison, my guest and others are now preparing for Vladimir Putin's fall and the creation of a modern, more peaceful Russia. I do strongly believe that one day Russia will become a free and democratic country, a part of the European family, where it belongs by its whole culture and history, he says. And on that note, welcome Leonid Volkov to Goldster Purpose, Passion and Grit.
Thank you so much. It's my great pleasure and honor to be here today.
Thank you, Leonid. And currently, correct me if I'm wrong, you are in Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania, is that right?
Yes, exactly. I'm in Vilnius. That's where we are now based, like hopefully for not such a long period of time, but we relocated the whole team of the Anti-Corruption Foundation from Russia last year, when last year we've been recognized a terrorist organization in Russia, so we couldn't operate anymore in our home country. We had to dissolve our foundation back in Russia, and then we moved it here to Lithuania, which was very friendly and welcoming, and we reassembled it here and relaunched our operations also in 2021 from Vilnius.
Just explain to us the Baltic states. There's Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. They're tiny countries, aren't they? But they're protected from Russia. Explain that.
Well, they're not that tiny, by the way. Like, Lithuania is larger than Netherlands by
is it goodness, yeah.
By its area. Yeah. And yeah, they are... they indeed are part of Europe, part of NATO. They were smart enough because they also know very good how to live it, like, under threat from Moscow. They have been occupied by Russia after the Second World War. Actually, they have been occupied by Stalin in 1940. Yeah. And they were forced to join the Soviet Union. And then, of course, after the end of the Second World War, they remained part of the Soviet Union. They regained their independence in 1991, and then they moved quickly, as quick as possible, to become members of European Union and NATO. So, and now these three Baltic states are really successful Eastern European democracies.
Yes, and do you feel safe there?
Well, to what extent is it possible to feel safe? So, I mean, we are the political movement of Putin's main enemy. Our leader has been poisoned, is now in a maximum security prison, suffers They're like enormously, and we are doing what he asks us to do. And all the projects that we here at the Anti-Corruption Foundation developed are, well, are projects against, targeted against Putin and against his war. So we, I mean, Putin has a perfect knowledge of what we are doing. We are the largest anti-Putin organization. We have like more than 100 employees. We are very active. We have like some 15 million followers on social media in Russia, so which is a huge number of supporters. So
incredible number,
Putin really considers us to be like a major threat. And of course, it includes some risks for us. So we take some security measures, security precautions, but also we don't have to think about the security risks too much, because otherwise, well, that would paralyze our ability to work. And of course, our work is the most important thing. We are very much devoted to all our, well, operations.
I want to get to, later on, I want to ask exactly what that is and ask your blueprint for Russia in the future. But firstly, I'd like to take you back to your childhood, how you were raised, and the period and atmosphere of your childhood, because I think you were 9 or 10, weren't you, when the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, and that issued in Glasnost and the friendlier time with the West. Give us an idea of that time for you.
Yeah, I was raised in quite a typical family of Soviet academic intelligentsia. Like, my father was and is a algebra professor, a mathematician at the Ural State University. So in my home city, Katrinburg is a large city, like 1.5 million people. It's Russia's fourth largest city. It's very well like developed economically. And it has been always a very liberal city, also actually hometown for Boris Yeltsin, the first president of the independent Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union. And the city where, well, people used to live a very hard life during the Soviet times because of like everything was sparse. You really had to spend hours in lines to buy like bread or milk or some like very basic food supplies. But everyone was like really very much involved in the politics. It was very natural, like for all families at that point of time in the end of 80s, just like to follow everything, to follow all the debate in Moscow during the perestroika times, all these Communist Party conferences where Gorbachev was struggling against Yeltsin. I don't remember exactly the fall of the Berlin Wall, probably because like the foreign policy events were of not that much importance for us in our city, but we all followed, and I remember it very vividly, like in my early childhood, like watching TV with my parents, like the party conference in 1989, when a competitive election was called for the first time, the first Soviet competitive elections in 1990, the presidential elections in the independent Russia in summer 1991, the putsch attempt of the like conservative military junta in August 1991, and the defeat of this junta. In August 1991, everyone was absolutely sure communism is over. Communism is over, and like Russia is facing like a beautiful future. We were naive. I mean, they were naive. I was just 10 years old, so I was naive by
you were a kid, weren't you?
But also like my parents and all people around who were just like celebrating the fall of communism, whom they were like really very tired of, were very happy. And of course, no one expected what kind of difficulties the country will actually face, because the country has gone through two major turmoils at the same time. One is a change from planned economy to free market economy. Like, and it was something. It was a shock for so many families, for millions of people. Imagine, in a planned economy, you were supposed to have a profession and to do this through all of your life. The unemployment rate was officially 0%. Everyone was given a job and given a task. Like, you have to produce 20 items of something every month. You don't care about how these 20 items are being sold. Does anyone need them? Does anyone want to buy them? And if in the next village there might be a similar factory where a factory worker just like you has a monthly plan to dismantle those 20 items.
So in that situation that you were growing up with, we have a question in from Alla Diorgio, forgive me, Alla, if I'm pronouncing that wrong. Your first question about Navalny, I'll wait for a bit, but free flat, this is a question, free flats, houses, best free medicine and free education. Was it a hard life?
It looks like Alla never lived in a communist country and never used to live in the Soviet Union. So first of all, nothing is free. Everything was paid by taxpayers' money. So at the end of the day, like, nothing is free. The quality of life was very bad. This so-called free flats were like tiny and like really mediocre. And the so-called free medicine was of very bad quality. And this is, we can judge by objective criteria such as
the quality of the medicine was not
you can judge by objective criteria, yeah, like, yeah, life duration, life expectancy or something like this, yeah, or like the statistics on different health issues. At the end of the day, even like if you would like the a system of education or a system of healthcare in Russia, well, I can't smile reading about the best in the world Russian medicine. Well, the thing is, it's Russian medicine. It's really not the best because, like, well, even now the life expectancy for men is 16 years.
And I'm not sure what that COVID vaccine was like. But I just want to say to our audience.
But the thing is that, first of all, like, if you spent just like 2 hours in the morning as a small child being sent to shop to buy bread, you don't really care about the like quality of healthcare or education.
I just want to say to everybody, ask questions to Leonard. He told me before we went live that he's a politician and he will answer anything. So you can challenge him, and well, I'll feed it into him if it's. Angie says there's no freedom to choose another leader, no freedom to travel outside of the Soviet Union either. When you were, you were 10, say, if we take that 1989, 9 or 10, then when did you realize, when did you start thinking the direction that your life wanted to go in, that your politics, your values?
Yeah, I just wanted to finish my thought that was like a bit interrupted by Alice's question. Like, the first shock that Soviet people experienced there in 1991 was when the planned economy was dismantled and market economy took its place and everyone was totally unprepared for. Like, in Soviet Union, like, money existed, like Soviet rubles, but the concept of that money, its value was absolutely different. People didn't know anything about how banks work, how stock exchanges work, what is it to be an entrepreneur, how do you do like marketing or something like this, because all of this was not necessary in the planned economy. And also the second huge turmoil was that the authoritarian political regime was replaced by a competitive democracy. These two things coincided in time, but they are different, and that's very important. We know about regimes that, for instance, transitioned from a single party to multi-party politics, remaining market economies.
And how old were you, or give me an idea of you're there in your sort of city thinking about this. You're an adolescent. How did it percolate? What were you discussing with your friends at the time?
Yeah, well, I was more discussing it with my parents and their friends, but also at school. At school, we discussed it a lot. So just let me finish it briefly, this very important idea, because I really believe it's very important for the definition of Putinism and where we are now in Russia. The idea is that these two shocks, both of them very severe, coincided in time, and Putin used it. Like the early 90s were a very challenging time in terms of quality of life and economy, because millions of people lost everything. Their jobs were obsolete in the market economy, just didn't make any sense to exist, and they ceased to exist. So people had to adopt to an entirely different life with an entirely different economy they were not used for.
So did your parents find it difficult?
Yes, of course, everyone found. Salaries were not paid for many months. All the payments were delayed. The market really was a very wild one. People were just exchanging things for each other because no one had currency or something like this. And so on. So this economic shock, which also Allah refers to, coincided with a political shock of a different nature, of collapse of the Soviet Union, which economy was, of course, totally unfit for the 20th century and for the 21st century, and Putin weaponized it very wisely. That's still Putin's main selling point to the people. You recall how difficult was life in the 90s. That's because of democracy. That's because of political competition. You don't need to have democracy anymore. You don't need political competition, because you know what? When it happened, the times were so hard, economically. They were such a nightmare. So this is a blatant manipulation, a very naive one, very stupid one, but still you see people are buying it just because people were not able to differentiate these two very different things. Good news.
These two things that we found out that how long it takes to make it work and how difficult they are to match. But you ran for office, that's what we called. You became what we call here in Britain a local councillor. Why did you do that, and how did that? What made you think you wanted to go on this path and not become an engineer or an academic or something that?
So we discussed the 90s and my childhood when I was 10 years old or 12 years old when the Soviet Union collapsed, and then there was this 90s when my parents, as many other families, just struggled to survive, and then life became quite normal by the end of 90s with oil prices going up and
then salaries being paid.
And then everyone got used to market economy and everyone started to find ways to make money. I was a university student and I applied for a local software company and I started my career as a software developer back in 1998. And I spent 12 years. I spent 12 years working in the IT industry, but from my childhood, I kept a lot of interest in politics. And this is very typical. I discussed it many times with Alexei Navalny as well, and with many other friends. The generation born between 1975 and 1982, which we belong to. We are the generation whose childhood was extremely politicized, and we continued to follow politics afterwards. Then let's zoom to 2008. So I am a vice president of a huge software company, like a senior vice president. I like about 1,500 people report to me. Okay. And I run. It's a big company, and Russia's fourth or fifth largest software company. And like I earn a lot of money, and we run very successful projects. We do some very like innovative solutions for small businesses, like Russian TurboTax plus Russian Intuit. And my company, where I'm also a shareholder, is also a major taxpayer in my city. And well, then because I'm like politically involved, I started asking questions like, okay, how are my taxes spent? So my company is paying those taxes. I don't like how my city looks like. So maybe they should be used more wisely. And some of my friends, like really randomly, tells me, okay, there is an election to city council soon. Why don't you actually run? Why don't you go into like local politics? It was in fall 2008, and I still don't know if I should say thank you to that friend of mine, or I should say he ruined my life. Yeah, because
so you chose the political path when you could have become Elon Musk.
Wow, hopefully not Elon Musk, but yeah,
Jeff Bezos or something.
by all measures, I used to have a very successful career in IT. My shares were worth several million dollars, and the company was very successful at all. So, but yeah, I decided I want to try it. And once again, as we discussed, it was quite typical for my generation to be like interested in politics and to try our ways
interrupt, but when you were thinking of going, or when you were running for politics and you made that decision, how much were you drawing from the Western democratic vision, as it were, and how much were you drawing from your own internal thoughts of what Russia should be?
Well, so I used to live in the West for a while. So I spent a year in Germany as a high school student. Then I spent half a year in the Netherlands to study something, and so on. I traveled a lot and so on. So of course I had an idea of like how Western democracy works, how it actually could also work. I saw that Russia is enormously rich as a country. Like oil and gas prices were enormously high at that point of time. And I saw that we are not getting like our chunk, not ourselves, but also not the country, not the infrastructure. Like the infrastructure in our cities remained very poor, and like the housing and the healthcare and education were like very run down. Despite the fact that, Putin and his people became already super rich by that point of time, around 2008. So Russia, by 2008, Russia made it to the second place in the world by the headcount of billionaires after US, because of the oil and gas money. But the quality of life, especially far from Moscow, was really.
And how was when that was? How was your personal quality of life with your software company?
Yeah, well, my personal quality of life was very high, like by Russian standards, it was very high. Yeah, it was like quite successful. Yeah. But I have to admit, Tim, when I was running for office back there in 2008, I didn't have an idea like to change Russia or so on. And no one had this idea. We thought, okay, I mean, the country is developing in the right way. Like the economy is growing, and like all, like the last 10 years between 1998 and 2008 were 10 years of like uninterrupted economic growth. We just want to fix some things. We want to understand better how the system works. We as a like younger generation, and we want as a younger generation probably like to help the government like to steer the country in a better direction. So I was not, you know, like I never voted for Putin, for instance. I never voted for Unite Russia, for his party, but I was not a revolutionary also.
Okay, but a question, interesting question from Angie, says, how did things change for you as a Russian Jew after the fall of the Soviet regime and again into the Putin regime? Is that, has that been a factor at all?
No, I can't say this. So it was not like very important. I didn't really face anything like anti-Semitic, for instance, in my childhood. That would probably like cause me to think more about like how things are wrong around us. And it was and remains always a very important part of my self-identification. But it was not anything specifically reflecting on my like political career.
So anti-Semitism is not a part of it. Your actual values and mind were somewhere else. You weren't fighting against something.
It existing, and now it is growing. And of course, now we see a lot of anti-Semitism in Russia. But for my childhood and early years, it was not something that like defined my way.
And when did you realize you ran a very successful software company, you were running for your local council or deputy. When did you realize about the power of the internet? What you and Navalny, Alexei harnessed later on. When did you say, yes, this is the way to go?
Well, as my company was developing like software for that was like internet based, I always knew actually how important the power of internet was. And in 2008, while creating my own political campaign, I decided to rely on the internet like a lot. I recruited volunteers for my campaign over internet. I ran a very like public blog about every my step on the campaign trail. I crowdfunded on the internet. I believe it was the first ever political crowdfunding campaign in Russia, as that I did there then in winter 2008-2009. It was a bit inspired, definitely, by like Western practices. I read about Obama's campaign, which happened a few months before. I read about the Obama campaign, and it was definitely a source of inspiration. Grassroots campaigning and crowdfunding on the internet were taken from there.
That is fascinating. So you were able to get your message to the grassroots without, campaigning through television stations, and that you got them straight in there.
Yes, of course. It was a local election. My district had about 30,000 or 35,000 voters. So it was more of a like door to door campaign. So I just like made like 82 or 84 like personal meetings. Like I went like to every like residential block in my district, and I just like told with I just spoke to local residents first of all.
Did you enjoy that?
It was January and February 2009. It was below 20 degrees, below minus 20 degrees in Yekaterinburg, which is like in Siberia, almost in Siberia, in Urals, like on the border between Europe and Asia. And well, but it was a very interesting experience, like really to leave my large, beautiful office and to go just to talk with regular babushkas at regular residential blocks. It was eye-opening.
Yeah, it was. Now, I want to move on to your relationship and the work that you do at the moment with Alexei Navalny. Firstly, tell us, who is he?
Well, so Alexei Navalny is a very talented and passionate politician. He's a guy who, first of all, thinks is a real like political animal who feels very good, like what people need and what people want. He's like really very connected with people. And he really believes in what he says. He really has his values. He really believes that Russia deserves better. This country with its great history and great people can be a proper, decent, successful, rich European country, a efficient democracy, and so on. He believes, and I share his beliefs, that Putin is not typical, that it's an historical mistake, that Russia actually is designed to be like part of Europe culturally, politically, historically.
How did you meet Alexei?
I met him in 2010. It was, one of the conferences of democratic forces. When I got elected to city council of Yekaterinburg, which was and is Russia's fourth largest city, suddenly I found myself in a very funny position. Putin already destroyed democratic opposition by the point of time. Like, democratic opposition was not present in the State Duma, so in the federal parliament. Neither it was present in regional parliaments. So being elected as an independent member of a city council of one of Russia's largest top cities, I kind of like found myself to be the like almost the top elected independent politician in the country. All other members of my city council, like, we had 35 seats, and my 34 colleagues, more or less all of them, like, were members of United Russia, Putin's party.
So you were the only opposition or the only independent member in the council?
Yes, yes.
Goodness.
And yeah. So I got noticed. And so when, like, Democrats and liberals wanted to talk about, like, okay, how do we want to resist the regime? What could we do? What are our ideas like to... for the pro-democracy movement, they, of course, wanted that their conference wouldn't look like just like some people inside Moscow discuss something. They wanted to invite people from regions. They wanted to like invite other politicians, like, for the sake of representation. But there was not so many to choose from, and I was a very natural choice. So I started to get invited to like many conferences in Moscow where like prominent old democratic leaders such as Boris Nemtsov or former deputy prime minister who was shot dead in 2015, or Mikhail Kasyanov, the former prime minister, would sit together and like and discuss how Putin is wrong. And I went to a few of these conferences, and during one of them, and it was in June 2010, I met Alexei Navalny, who was my generation and so very different from these older folks who just discussed how Putin is wrong. I was still in the IT business, but the point of time, both doing, like, being a local counselor, but also still working with my IT company. And for me, this like very concrete, very project-based approach was very dear and very understandable. Like, while Nemtsov and Kasyanov and others, with all due respect, like, discussed political statements they would make to contest some of Putin's actions, Navalny would think in terms of not statements, but actions. Like, okay, there is a problem. Let's think of a practical project that we can launch to tackle this problem, to address it, and also to solve it. So his approach was very different, and I like it very much.
And you
started to work together very soon.
I mean, you teamed up with him such that you became his chief of staff in the next election, didn't you? You ran his campaign for him.
Yes, he asked me to be his chief of staff in Moscow mayoral election of 2013. And yeah, I believe for the reasons that I had some IT knowledge, my own successful experience of campaigning on internet, on crowdfunding and so on, and also because I was not from Moscow, which was very important because the Moscow political scene was like democratic. Scene was all stuffed with people who hated each other and had like very old, difficult story of difficult relationships. I didn't belong to this small circle, so I could work with anyone.
And when did you realize, when did you and Navalny and those you were working with realize that politics were actually becoming life-threateningly dangerous and you had to move or you were going to be jailed or you were going to be attacked?
Well, so I left Russia in 2019 in August, so 3 years ago, when criminal charges were pressed against me. And we realized that if I don't leave immediately, I'll just go behind bars. Before that, I've been arrested, like detained many times. I spent like over 220 days under arrest. But these were all like small punishments for like what they call running an unsanctioned rally, like unsanctioned protest rally, something like this. Now, the new charges that they pressed like in August 2019 could yield me like 10 years prison time. And we discussed it with Alexei and we decided I better leave because it was very important like to keep the organization alive, to keep the organization up and running. Alexei Navalny is a team player. It's very important to understand. He's not just like a dissident, a sole vote of protest in an like ocean of silence, but he was able to build a very capable political organization, like to create an organization that is large, runs many different projects and is really, well, a pain in Putin's ass.
It's a, now we have amongst our guests somebody who I think is does not share your views. I just wondered if you could address a couple of the points that they're raising. One of them is about, you mentioned him being poisoned, but says apparently he was drunk on the, this is Alexei, was drunk on the plane. And another one about a shooting in a nightclub in 2007. I'm sure you've heard these before. Can you give us...
Yeah, but it would require a lot of context. But yeah, well, Allah also enjoyed living in the Soviet Union, which really makes you like belong to a different world than me. But yeah, a lot of people know, she writes that Navalny was not poisoned, but was drunk at the plane. The thing, it was the first line of the propaganda. Like when Navalny collapsed, when he fell into coma and the emergency link was necessary to save his life, the first thing the Russian propaganda, this infamous TV host Vladimir Solovyov said, he was just drunk. Interesting is that Allah still sticks with that line of propaganda, while the official propaganda narrative has changed many times since. And it's very typical for how they operate. That's if you recall, like the Boeing MH17 shut down in July 2014 with 298 people lives lost. They told, this is not us, these are Ukrainians, we saw a Ukrainian fighter. Then when satellite images arrived, because they told
the evidence came through, didn't it?
No, it is not a fighter. It is a book missile, but it is not our book missile. This is like Ukrainian book missile, etc., etc., etc. They always, you know, like they try to increase the level of white noise. They don't care that their narratives contradict each other. They don't care that their messages are so many different. But it's very important to give an impression, just a second, that everything is so unclear, like really covered by a fog. So after that propaganda said Navalny was drunk at the plane, after, well, a medical analysis arrived showing that he is actually poisoned, they said, okay, he poisoned himself. That is what Putin okay. famously in his press conference. And then when it was revealed that a squad of FSB poisoners went after him during the last 3 years of his trips through the regions, Putin also said, and Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, said, Germans poisoned him on the plane. So the thing is that according to official version of Russian propaganda, Alexei Navalny was never poisoned, but he poisoned himself, but the Germans poisoned him on the plane. And that's how Russian propaganda operates. They don't care about inconsistency of their versions, but they know that some of their versions would probably stick with someone. So that it happened with Alla and her Alla was drunk on the plane.
We've got the two different things. Alla, I hope you're a little bit happy with that answer. We engaged with your question. But Angie mentions talking about poison. And when we met in Vilnius in April, I don't know if you were joking or not, you insisted that you wiped my coffee glass of water that I was having in case I had Novichok on it.
it was a joke, of course. And my point that I wanted to make is exactly that, you know, I don't want to care too much about like possible attacks, because frankly, I mean, there is no proper way to defend yourself against such types of attacks. I mean, really, if they really want to do it, they probably will get to you. But thinking about it all the time, like trying to just like thinking 24/7 that, okay, this item may be poisoned and this doorknob may be poisoned and so on, would just like paralyze your will and would actually make your work impossible or like obsolete. This is a gift that we want give to Putin.
That is fascinating. I wanted to actually talk about your blueprint for a future Russia. You have been, I'm not sure if you still are, liaising with Alexei Navalny from his jail cell. Can you explain how that to and fro works or works?
Actually, almost not anymore, because the connections between Alexei and the outer world are now being cut. So he was officially deprived of his client attorney privilege, and he's the only one prisoner in Russia who doesn't enjoy this client attorney privilege. So his attorneys are not allowed to exchange any documentation with him anymore in private. All communication we have now is only through like official mail, which is censored. And the censors are allowed just to, you know, erase everything they don't like. So our communication is really very, very extremely limited now. And things actually went worse when Alexei published his Washington Post op-ed a few months ago, where he presented his ideas about post-Putin Russia, about how a democratic Russia should look and should work. So it looks like the mere discussion of the post-Putin Russia is something like so painful for President Putin that he ordered just like really to cut any Alexei's communication to the outer world.
Can you outline that? Firstly, before you outline that vision for Russia, what are his conditions in prison like? Do you have any idea?
Yes, of course, we know it very good. His conditions are enormously bad now. He's now being held in a solitary confinement in a punishment cell. It is 2.5 by 3.5 meters large or small. It has just like a hole in the floor, a chair, a small table, and a foldable bed. And the bed is folded against the wall between 5 a.m. and 9 p.m. So he can rest only for 8 hours In the night. It is definitely a torture condition, like by definition of torture condition. But well, that's where he's now. That's how they're trying to break his will. He's not breaking though, and still, despite the very limited ways of communication, he maintains contact with us, with his team. He uses every of his days in court as a opportunity to speak out loud against Putin and against the war.
Give us as much detail as you can. I mean, we had the fall of communism and the chaos that followed that. You mentioned these two things coming together, the market economy and the old system, and it didn't work. If Putin disappears tomorrow, what plans do you have to bring Russia into what you want it to be, a modern, European state?
This is my point. This is very, very important. So Putin, for many years, used this narrative of stability to silence his opponents and to get like public support. Like, I am the only one who can ensure your stability. I am the only one who saved you from the nightmares of the 90s. And without me, Russia will be turbulent once again, and this 90s will repeat. This is a narrative that he was able to sell to many of his supporters in Russia, and also to Allah in our chat window. And this is wrong. This is the point I was trying to make. When Putin is removed, or when he dies, and we are able to reestablish political competition and rule of law, independent courts, and free and fair elections, in terms of economy, nothing bad will happen. Contrary, as Russian people are now experienced with entrepreneurship, with private business, with free market, with how to produce something that is of market value, and how to sell it, and how to invest, and how to build. And Russia has actually revealed enormous technological and entrepreneurial talent within the last 30 years. Russia will flourish.
But how will you get the military, the intelligence services, the Kremlin, all of those institutions that over the past 20 years have loyally supported Vladimir Putin and his operation? How will you get them on side?
Look, they are very not homogeneous. They are very different. Putin's system operates due to the fact that his many lieutenants really hate each other and compete against each other. So that's the reason why they actually need Vladimir Putin as their like supreme arbiter for all their conflicts. When he's gone, there will be enormous level of political turbulence, but this will also be a window of opportunities for us, for democratic opposition, for all supporters, and so on. Putin doesn't have a successor. Putin isn't allowed to have a successor by design of his system, because should he appoint a successor, he would become a lame duck at the same moment. Every one of his lieutenants will run to leak successor's shoes, just as it happened in Kazakhstan very recently. So when Putin is gone, the system will become unstable, but for democratic forces, this will present an enormous opportunity. Maybe I have to answer a few questions from chat, because there are now very good questions.
Oh, no, I just want to finish this, then I'm going to feed you the chat thing. So, I mean, how would you avoid... let's put it another way. One of the problems that has arisen is the West being too, or Russia during those early years being too compliant with the West, and too much of Western ideology being imported into Russia. How would you avoid that? How would you strike that balance?
With all due respect, I don't agree. After the fall of Soviet Union, Russia was too much left on its own. So the West looked to believe that after the Soviet Union was defeated in the Cold War, and after like democracy was installed in Russia, that will be enough. And like democratic institutions will develop themselves. And like
it became a mafia state.
Will develop itself. No, it was not enough. It was not sufficient. Not much investment was made into institutional reforms, into helping Russia to develop a successful, competitive, liberal democracy. And not only Russia, like most of the post-Soviet states, with the exception of Baltic states, actually suffered from very similar problems. Many of them became dictatorships or were very unstable. So
you're confident, are you, that you could push, that you could make it work, you could get the balances and the timing right this time?
Of course, just because now we are much better experienced, and also as a point that I was trying to make, now we will not have to deal with two major perestroikas at the same point of time.
Right, so you just have one thing instead of the two competing elements that you said before. Yes, let us go now to the things, because we are running out of time. Let me just think. Lilette says she'd be scared of falling off a building, not the poison. Lilette asks, do you think Putin would press the nuclear button?
Frankly,
Ukraine, yes.
Thank you for this question, but frankly, we didn't know. And so we have to disregard this threat. He is crazy enough. He is desperate enough. He knows he loses the war, so he might think of whatever solutions. But it can't be influenced from abroad. There is nothing we can do to impact the probability of him pushing or not pushing that button. There is no way that we could allow ourselves into some type of negotiation or appeasement. Like, okay, dear Mr. Putin, don't push the button. We will yield you this, this, and this. We don't have to let him to use nuclear threat as a leverage, because if we let him, we lose. Because there is no counter-argument for this. This is the ultimate argument. Give me Kiev or I'll nuke you. Give me Warsaw or I'll nuke you. Give me London or I'll nuke you. If we allow this argument to sit with us at the table, we've lost. So yes, intellectual hygiene requires us just to disregard this. I realize it's a bit challenging, but we have to do it.
Okay, and Andrew's got a very interesting question here. Is if you and Navalny and your colleagues form a future administration, would you compensate the harm that's been inflicted upon Ukraine?
Yes, of course. That's self-evident. Russia has caused enormous harm to Ukraine, and while lives lost can be repaired, of course the economic damage has to be repaired, and that's an absolutely obvious thing. And yes, the future Russia will be able to compensate, because Russia still remains an enormously rich country, and all these international resources that have been...
And you would order an immediate withdrawal?
Have to be used for this. Sorry?
Two things. Is that I presume you would order an immediate withdrawal, but would you be happy for Ukraine to join NATO?
I mean, I don't care. That is the decisions that Ukraine and NATO countries have to make. But we have to be reminded that when Putin ran for re-election for the first time in 2004, it was Putin who was running for re-election and having on his program EU membership and NATO membership for Russia.
That's one very quick question, and then I'm going to have to let you go because I know you've got a meeting to go to, so we're going to end 5 minutes early. Angie, tell us about the Society for the Protection of the Internet. Are the hackers managing to keep one step ahead?
Well, the Internet Protection Society is my side project, a pet project, where I still try to stay up to date with the IT things as a former IT professional, I have to admit it, a former one. With a few friends of mine, we try to develop tools to resist Internet censorship developed in Russia. It is not always not successful. And actually, well, Internet remains still, well, not anymore a safe haven for free speech in Russia, but still Internet remains a platform where independent political opinions and ideas can be distributed. Also because of some technical things that we are doing, also because of political campaigning. We are educating people how to install and use VPNs. We are educating people how to use cryptocurrencies. We educate people how to avoid Russian censorship and blacklist and so on. So I think it's quite an important job that we are doing. But of course, well, it's not my day job. I don't have too much time spent on it.
This is the modern weapon against dictatorship. Before you go, get 30 seconds, give us your last thought about your work and the future of Russia.
Thank you so much, Humphrey, for this opportunity. I actually still have almost 4 minutes.
I have to give them promos, so you have 3 minutes. Off you go.
Sure. Thank you so much for this invitation. And I have to say that, well, optimism is a job requirement, of course, for us here at the Anti-Corruption Foundation. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to do what we are doing. But I want you, dear friends, to share this optimism. Russia, the Soviet, post-Soviet Russia, has managed to overcome the most important struggle, the most important transition from a planned economy to market economy. Now, this is the second wave of transition. We have to leave the authoritarianism behind. Yes, it's complicated. It's a bloody mess that Putin created. And of course, the lives lost will not be repaired. But everything else that is in our capacity, we will repair. The damages, the and everything. And Russia can work as a successful democracy, prosperous, and not being a threat to its neighbors, a proper European country. Russia deserves it. Russian people can work, can live in such an environment. And we will be able to prove that Putin was just a historical mistake.
Thank you very much. And we said you've got a few more minutes. Would you like Russia to be part of the European Union?
Yes, of course. I mean, I personally would like it very much. But then, of course, once again, it's for Russian citizens and European citizens to decide.
Yes. Leonard Volkov, thank you so much for being with us. You have to run now, but it's been a real pleasure. We've got a last message in. Angie, thank you for your immense courage and energy. That is the ingredients of purpose, passion, and grit, which is what this show is about. And please come back with more updates. When should we expect the next update from you and Navalny and everybody?
Thank you, Angie. Thank you, Humphrey. The pleasure is all mine. Well, follow the news. It's all in the news. Hopefully, we'll also hear some very positive updates soon.
Okay, brilliant. We'll let you go. I'm just going to tell our wonderful audience about the promos. But, Leonard, thank you so much. And we will keep in touch. And we'll let the Goldster audience know all your developments from now on. And now, lovely people we have coming up. Now, this is given our fantastic conversation that we had just now with Leonard, we have on Thursday, December the 15th, Lucinda is with Mark Aldridge with his book, Hercule Poirot, The Greatest Detective in the World. Mark was due to join us in September during the Agatha Christie theme month, but I think he got COVID or something and it didn't happen, but he's with us this week. And then on Friday, I'm with Alex Shaw, a best-selling thriller writer, and his latest is based on conflict zones in eastern Ukraine. So we're going to be talking about, do readers want their fiction to go behind the headlines, or do they want to read something that avoids the headlines? And then on Thursday, December the 22nd, I am back, for those of you who might remember last year, with Sir Muir Grey, the Golster superstar and the fantastic author of two hilarious and insightful books, aptly named Sod 60 and Sod 70. I had one of them here, but I can't put my finger on it at the moment. And I think this is an in-person live event. So Muir and myself will be together at Riverstone in Kensington. And it'll also, of course, be streamed all over the world. Friday, December 23rd, Lucinda is with Jeremy Seal. And this does look good. Nicholas, the epic journey from saint to Santa Claus. St. Nicholas is one of our most influential saints. And then December 29th, I am with the ebullient and avuncular chair of the Crime Writers Association, Maxine Jakubowski, who works, his works include The Return of Sherlock Holmes and The Mammoth Book of Erotica. I never thought I would say those two things in the same sentence. Please join us then, December 29th. And December 30th, as I've said before, here it is. Our book of the month is Truman Capote's Breakfast at Tiffany's, a classic with a legendary movie starring Audrey Hepburn. It is a thin read. So watch it, read it, watch the movie, and we'll discuss that on December the 30th. So until later in this week with Lucinda, Time's Winged Chariot has approached, and what a wonderful insight into the life and struggles that Leonard gave us. I mean, for me, it was a fantastic learning curve. And thank you all for your comments, questions. Thank you, Alla, too. And I hope that we satisfied a little bit of your questions there, because it is the most pressing issue of our time. Until Thursday with Lucinda and Hercule Poirot, stay curious, stay involved, stay reading, stay connected, and of course, stay Golster. Goodbye. Bye. Thank you for listening, and find out our vast range on www.golster.co.uk. Our vision is to help people stay stimulated, active, socializing, and empowered in what we say live happier and healthier for longer. The podcast is one of many strands, which includes nutrition, yoga, art, singing, languages, brain power, love, and many, many others, more than 300, all from the comfort of your home. If you like what you hear, please press that big subscribe button and tell your friends, family, colleagues, community, and yes, your enemies too, about what Golster does. Spread the word about our incredible range of guests and subject, and until next time, goodbye from all of us at Golster.